This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ron Insano. Welcome to the U.S. Lens. I'm a senior advisor at Schroders North America. And as you well know, as we emerge from the COVID pandemic around the world, it's happening at different paces with different issues facing each of the countries that has gone through the pandemic experience over the last 15 months. In the U.S., investors are getting nervous about inflation. In other parts of the world, investors are worried about slow growth. What are the biggest risks to the investment thesis that we all carry going forward, and what are the potential rewards? Joining me now to discuss that is Johanna Kirkland. She's Group CIO and Global Head of Multi-Asset Investments at Schroders. And Johanna, it's a pleasure to talk to you again. Thanks for being with us today.
Hello.
Let's start first with the U.S., because like China, it is almost now fully emerging from the setbacks that we saw, to put it mildly, in the pandemic environment. And here first, there are a lot of jitters about inflation. And some people worry about it as a structural phenomenon. The Fed believes it to be transitory. When you look at inflationary pressures, both in the U.S. and around the world, what exactly do you see?
Well, I think there are some transitory effects, in particular with regard to commodity prices and the energy price in particular, because of year-on-year comparisons, when last year, as you remember, the oil price had collapsed. But I do think there is a bit of a challenge in the sense that demand patterns have been so disrupted even as we reopen. And so what we're seeing in many cases is companies struggling to meet the demand that they're seeing in their specific areas. And I think while this demand remains disrupted, I think there is a risk of inflation spikes in different sectors month by month. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's just transitory. I think that it is caused by disruption and it's likely to continue.
Yeah, let me ask you about that, because there is a difference in a certain sense between supply shortages and generalized inflation. I mean, the 70s and early 80s, which was a global phenomenon where we saw inflation in double digits around the world, was a result of a wide variety of factors, not just one set of circumstances. How do you distinguish between supply chain disruptions, tariffs on specific items, particularly in the U.S., like lumber, maybe a shortage of housing relative to demand, versus the type of structural inflation we saw 50 years ago?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The way you characterize it, I think, is exactly right. That at the moment, what we're seeing is supply disruptions. So ultimately, it's pockets of inflation. While really what we saw in the 70s was very widespread inflation. Initially started off by commodity prices, but also fed through wages. So really what we need to see a more structural rise in inflation is that kind of wage price spiral. And we're not there yet. I think that's something that we might have to consider in years to come. But I think concerns about that kind of spiral are still premature.
And the concern these days largely comes from the excessive, some say, excessive amounts of stimulus being thrown at various economies, whether it's China and their hoarding basic materials, whether it's Europe and the United States throwing as much money as is humanly possible at this economic recovery. Some fall back to Milton Friedman and say we're going to have too much money chasing too few goods. And so a monetary phenomenon will lead to structural inflation. How do you deal with that argument?
I'm not convinced by that because, for example, in Japan, we've seen a lot of money thrown at the system and ultimately inflation didn't pick up. I think what we need to monitor is conditions in the labor market. Now, obviously, again, in the 70s, you had a much higher level of unionized labor, which mm-hmm. potentially contributed to inflation. Maybe we don't have that today. But I think one thing we need to monitor is that the political pendulum is swinging towards creating more inclusive growth because of the increase in income inequality in recent years. And that could give more power to the labor share of GDP than what we've seen over the last couple of decades. But for me, the labor market is critical to the inflation view. I don't worry about too much money chasing goods.
Now we do see some pressure, as you mentioned, or as you hinted, that we're seeing the labor share of national income go up. And so we're starting to see, strangely enough, with over 8.5 million people unemployed in the United States, labor shortages in specific areas, and companies from Walmart to McDonald's to others offering wage increases, one-time incentives to take on a job, promises of six-figure positions over a period of several years of training. Is it possible that wage acceleration is already in the pipeline, particularly in the United States?
Again, I think it's in pockets, but I think that is a risk. And that's the risk we're really watching. I think the good news is that to the extent you want a position for higher inflation, those positions that benefit from higher inflation are still looking relatively cheap. So the US 10-year is still around 1.6%. And so in that sense, you can position for that higher inflation quite cheaply right now by being underweight bonds, for example. But I think I do think there's that upward risk. There is a risk that wage prices could be accelerating. Absolutely.
Now, there are some folks as we emerge from the pandemic environment who are talking about the roaring 20s, both domestically and abroad. Now, going back to the 1920s, that didn't end well. When we talk about the reemergence from this pandemic-induced recession, market disruption, what have you, how is this different from other periods of reemergence that we've seen in prior cycles?
Well, that's a good question. I think that in some senses, you know, we've been comparing this environment to people coming out of wars. And I guess the big difference with wars is that a lot of productive capacity is destroyed in the process. This is a rather sad subject we got onto. But, you know, the big difference this time round is that you haven't seen productive capacity get destroyed. So you don't have the same rebuilding efforts that you might have had after wars. And that would argue against the same level of demand that we saw, for example, after the Second World War, because you have the Roaring 20s, you also had, in some sense, the Roaring 50s. You know, we don't have to rebuild in the same way. I guess one exception is that, again, as a result of the crisis, we've seen an acceleration in focusing on green infrastructure, for example. That might be an area where we see more upward pressure on prices. And, you know, but ultimately, I don't think we're having to rebuild the way we did after the World Wars, obviously. So I wouldn't necessarily assume that we're going to end up with a roaring 20s scenario.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I mean, largely, particularly after World War II, the productive capacity of the developed world was utterly destroyed in Europe and Japan. China wasn't online yet. India, although it's suffering now, wasn't online. Latin America, from an economic standpoint, wasn't a big contributor to global growth, and the U.S. enjoyed 45 to 50% of global GDP at the time. So this is a much more diverse global economy than it was after the war as well, no?
Yes, and I think what's interesting is that the pandemic has kind of forced us into a slightly deglobalized state. So, you know, even before this, if you remember in 2018, when we were discussing the trade wars, you know, there was talk about an end of globalization. And as we know, globalization ultimately was something that depressed prices globally. Because the way the pandemic has played out, you know, even as we get vaccinated, actually that's resulting in some cases in international borders going up, not down. Actually, we're existing in a slightly deglobalized state. I think, again, that ultimately can reduce growth in some sense, but also puts upward pressure on prices. It comes back to what we've been discussing, the potential for inflation to pick up.
Is that the biggest threat you see to a full-scale economic recovery that's highly productive?
Yeah, that's what surprised me in some sense. I mean, I think pandemic has surprised us all, but I would have expected international travel to resume more quickly. I mean, I know in the US, you know, obviously you have the luxury of traveling extensively within your own continent, so you don't have this challenge. But what we're seeing in Europe and Asia is that it's very difficult to travel internationally. And I think that's likely to persist, you know, for another 12 months at least.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
A couple of months ago, individuals said, and economists and others have been talking about the possibility of a synchronized global economic recovery. Is that less likely this time around?
I think it is slightly less. I mean, in some sense, we're getting a synchronized upturn because we're all, you know, relative to where we were in terms of lockdowns globally last year, things have loosened everywhere. So there has been a synchronized upturn, but certainly different economies are following different paths because of different outcomes on the pandemic. So the US really is leading the world at the moment because your vaccination rate is so high. But that's not the case elsewhere. So, you know, we think there's potential for Europe to catch up now. As you probably know, Europe was a bit behind on its vaccination programs, but it's catching up quickly now. So potential upside in Europe, but for example, a lot of the emerging economies are still struggling significantly with COVID because they haven't had the same access to the vaccines. So it is very much, I think, less synchronized than even I would have expected a few months ago.
So I take it then you can't look at the world, particularly from an investment perspective, as being monolithic at the moment. You have to really almost take it apart country by country.
It is. Even, you know, people, I mean, we've always been of the view that you can't talk about emerging markets as one block because they clearly include many different countries. But I think today more than ever, even within emerging markets, you know, the significant divergence in what's happening economy by economy. And it's a function of COVID. It's a function of where they are in the supply chain. So, yes, it's interesting from that perspective.
Now, with respect to, and I'm going to maybe throw you a curveball here just because it's something that's been on my mind and to a certain extent, while we always deal with this issue as a potential, you know, kind of blindside risk, geopolitics seems to be becoming more important from an economic perspective than it's been in quite a while. You talk about deep globalization, but we're also seeing much more tension among the U.S. and China, Russia, the problems in the Middle East, North Korea, Iran. And granted, it's always been there, but it seems like there's an increasing amount of distrust, mistrust, if you will, and even the potential for altercations of some kind to affect not just economies, but markets as well. Is it something you're factoring in right now?
I think from a market standpoint, I mean, obviously, all kinds of conflicts are deeply distressing. But, you know, obviously, my job is to think about market implications. And the most important relationship for the market is the relationship between the US and China. And I think ultimately, you know, the two economies, the two powers are in a race for technological supremacy, which transcends who is in the White House. And so I think that is a feature that's going to continue for the foreseeable future. And you see two systems essentially being developed, right? Yes. So China uses different technology to the US. So again, I think that's a feature of our times that's likely to stay.
So, yeah, I mean, it's almost, and people have said this before, it's almost an economic Cold War versus the military Cold War we had with
yes.
Russia, although there are military components to this as well.
Yes, but ultimately it is about technological supremacy. And as you say, also, you know, as part of that, also access to resources.
Now, with respect to deploying capital in an environment like this, which as we've now discussed, is in the vein of an uneven, at least temporarily uneven, economic recovery, we have had discussed in the past with others the so-called Schroeder's trade, where most of our investment teams favor small over large, value over growth, international over domestic. Is that a theme that you are running with, or do you see other ways to deploy capital in this environment?
I agree with the value tilt because I think the biggest risk we face right now is that bond yields go up. If bond yields stay well behaved, I think markets can continue to grind higher. But I think, as I said, we've been discussing the potential sources of inflationary pressure. And although we're not in the camp of saying we're going back to the 1970s, we're not worried about the monetary issues, we have to recognize there's been a lot of disruption. And, you know, also the potential for the labor market to tighten and wages to go up. International versus the US. I mean, I tend to be more bullish on the US. I think that, again, the US continues to dominate from a growth standpoint, even in its recovery from the pandemic. And so I still think there's a lot of opportunity in the States as well. And I would probably favor developed markets over emerging markets for what it's worth right now, partly because of the outcomes on COVID. And small versus large, I mean, I tend to agree. I think there's more opportunity as you go down the market cap scale just to find we've been in a very macro-driven environment. A lot of the obvious trades have been done. And I think sort of moving away from the crowds and looking for less well-known names and more undiscovered opportunities is appropriate as this cycle matures.
Are there any other risks to not just that thesis, but really the bull market thesis or the bull market and everything thesis that has been playing out of late? We've seen a fair amount of speculative activity, particularly here in the States, whether it's SPACs, whether it's cryptocurrencies, whether it's retail participation in day trading and financial markets, something I haven't seen, quite frankly, like this since the late 1990s. Is there something you're keeping an eye on as a kind of canary in the coal mine when it comes to the so-called bull market and everything?
Well, I think, I mean, ultimately what put the bubble in the, so there's a number of features, you're right, which are similar to the 1990s. So for example, we saw the kind of outperformance of growth versus value in 2020 that we hadn't seen since the late 90s. So things have got very frothy on that front at one point. Ultimately, what killed the bull market, though, back then was that rates did go up.
Yep.
So I still think that bubbles need to be pricked by higher rates. And for me, the critical question, therefore, is the level of real yields, the level of the US 10-year, and what happens to inflation. I think that is really what's provided the underpinning. If you think about it, this bull market, like the bull market of the 1990s, was led by the US, and it was led ultimately by a low discount rate extending the cycle in the States. And so I think anything that could put up a pressure on that is what we have to keep focused on as a risk.
So watch the Fed, as always.
Watch the Fed. They've said they're going to be behind the curve, but, you know, I think as we progress, you know, that was something they said a year ago. You know, time moves on, and I think at some point there will be discussion about the withdrawal of liquidity and the potential for Fed rate hikes. And so, you know, we need to keep an eye on that. For me, that continues to be the biggest risk.
Johanna, always a pleasure. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Johanna Kirkland, Group CIO and Global Head of Multi-Asset Investments at Schroders. I'm Ron Insana. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back with another U.S. Lens in 2 weeks. Between now and then, take care, stay well, be safe.
Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to get in touch with us about anything on the show or give us ideas for future shows, you can email us at schroderspodcast@schroders.com. If you want to listen to the Investor Downloads back catalogue, and why wouldn't you? You can go to schroders.com/the Investor Download or rate, review and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. New shows are available every Thursday and every other Monday from 5 p.m. UK time. But above all, keep safe and go well. Cheers.